Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode focuses on constitutional limits on executive power, and in particular on President Trump's executive orders on immigration. In this hour, we'll hear from three distinguished professors from the School of Law at UC Berkeley. They include Daniel Farber, Peter Shook, and John Yoo. The event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience, and this broadcast is made possible by the generous support of Chevron. And now to our moderator, Jeffrey Bleich. He's CEO of Denton's Diplomatic Services and a former U.S. ambassador to Australia.
So, it has been quite a month. President Trump has issued two executive orders halting refugee processing and barring immigration of all persons from certain countries. He's issued an order directing officials to delay, defer, or stop enforcing aspects of the Affordable Care Act. There's been an order expediting approvals for all pipeline and other infrastructure projects, a memorandum promising a border wall, another memorandum on signing the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, an order changing the structure of the National Security Council, another order establishing ethics for everyone except the president, an executive order rescinding guidelines that prevent transgender discrimination, an executive order changing the hierarchy of the Department of Justice to change the 4th through 6th next in succession, which meant that after the firing of Sally Yates, the next person in line was the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia. So there were executive orders, there were presidential memoranda, there were what are called presidential determinations and presidential proclamations, and now there are about 7,000 other things that are presidential tweets that have a status that people are still trying to figure out. So I think people have a lot of questions. What do all these actions mean? So first, just a question, I'll direct it to Peter. Broadly speaking, what are the limits of a president's power? I mean, you've written a book recently, and what are the things that a president can clearly do? And then where are those areas where the president's power either brushes up against the power of coordinate branches or some other constitutional limitation?
Why do you get the easy ones?
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm not a constitutional scholar, unlike these two, so I could finesse it, but I won't. I'll just tell you my understanding and focus it on the famous Youngstown Steel case, decided in 1953, was it?
Yeah.
By the Supreme Court. And the most important feature of that decision was a concurring opinion by Justice Jackson, who was esteemed for a number of reasons. One, he had a great deal of real-world experience, and he was, I believe, chief counsel of the Nuremberg, chief prosecutor, rather, at the Nuremberg trials. But he also was the best writer on the Supreme Court at that time, and perhaps some would argue at any time. So his opinions enjoy unusual respect, I think, at least among legal scholars. And in his concurring opinion in that case, he sketched out a schema for the delineation of presidential power in conjunction with congressional power. And he distinguished three situations, and again, my two colleagues here are much better equipped than I to spell out how those have been applied. But he identified one situation in which the president seeks to act and Congress has been silent. In that situation, other things being equal, the president's power is at its apogee. And then situations in which the Congress has spoken to the issue that the president seeks to act on. And there he argued, essentially, I believe, that the president has no inherent authority to act. His authority to act depends upon the power that Congress grants him, plus any foreign affairs power that is inherent in the presidency. And Professor Yoo is again, a leading expert on that. And then there are situations in which the signals from Congress are somewhat mixed. In the immigration area, which is the area that I have studied most carefully in terms of this particular issue. The president has extraordinary power, and this is for several reasons. One is that immigration policy is thought to be an exercise of foreign affairs authority, and in that area, he has, as John Ewell explained, extraordinary power to begin with. So even immigration actions that are not closely related to foreign affairs still have that particular patina of foreign relations that add to his power there. In addition, Congress has granted the president very broad authority in the area that was impacted by the executive order concerning refugees from the various countries. Not just refugees, but anybody coming from those countries for a certain period of time. Section 215 of the statute, 215F specifically, basically sets no limits on the president's power to identify groups of aliens, which is the term used in the statute, who constitute a national security threat to the United States. All he needs to do is make findings. He doesn't have to support those findings. He merely has to find that their entry would be inimical to the interests of the United States, and they can be barred.
So there doesn't have to be a rational basis for those findings?
I don't think so. Or to make a somewhat narrow argument, the courts would certainly defer in this area to the president's findings. And I really doubt that there would be a rational basis for reversing that action. And the third, and then I'll conclude, the third thing is that the Supreme Court has recognized very broad authority in the Congress and to some extent in the president in a case that is now 135 years old, the Chinese exclusion case, which most people would believe that it's one of the stains on American U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence, but the Supreme Court does cite it and has cited it recently. And essentially, the Supreme Court in the Chinese exclusion case ruled that congressional authority in this area is virtually plenary, and it's led to what's called the plenary power doctrine. So you have Congress with a plenary power, you have the president with his own inherent authority growing out of his responsibilities in foreign affairs, and you have the Supreme Court that has blessed both of those.
So based on that, what's your take on the first executive order and the second executive order?
I think the first one on refugees, because there have been several that affect immigration. The one involving refugees, I think, is constitutional. The objections to it have been reduced somewhat by the revised executive order, but I think even the original executive order probably would have been constitutional. The main argument against it would have been a discrimination on the basis of religion in violation of the First Amendment religion clauses. And I think a court would probably find, and I think there's a strong argument to the effect that this was not a ban on Muslims. It was a ban on people from certain countries who are Muslims almost entirely, but that 95% of the Muslims in the world are not barred by this order, and I just don't think a court would look past that that rationale.
I wanted to add a little bit more on the constitutional side, more to give context than to disagree. I think one thing that's important to know is that the constitutional powers of the president have been contested since about the day George Washington took the oath of office. There have been strongly differing opinions. People in the executive branch, presidents tend to think that presidential powers are extremely broad. People in Congress tend to think that that's an exaggeration, that the president's powers are not nearly as broad as presidents say they are. The Supreme Court has only rarely intervened to be a referee. So what we really have are sort of clashing positions that only now and then you get something from a relatively neutral party about. And steel seizure is probably about as good as anything that we've had from the court in at least giving us a framework for thinking about the issues. But I did a book on Lincoln and the Constitution, and we had same arguments about whether Lincoln was a dictator, was he acting within his powers, did he need more authority from Congress? So we've been fighting about these issues a really long time.
Well, I think people looking at the immigration laws and the power of the president and how they've been reviewed by courts may be a bit confused, because they look at President Obama, who had limited the enforcement of deportations against people who were not here with documentation, saying that certain family situations by people who hadn't engaged in any illegal conduct, they shouldn't be deported. And the Fifth Circuit and other courts found that he had exceeded his powers. So on the one hand, we're hearing the president's got extraordinarily broad powers, keep people out and kick people out. But in other situations, when you've got a different president, different parties, you know, people who are appointed by different party members, sometimes get a different result as to the plenary authority of the president in immigration. How do you explain that to the public?
I'm turning to our immigration expert.
Well, the immigration policy is a very, very complex one, politically and of course, legally. Americans have very mixed feelings about immigration. We, on the one hand, we're all, I think almost all of us, are proud of our immigrant ancestry, and we tend to like immigrants a lot. We don't like immigration nearly as much as we like immigrants, according to public opinion polls.
We like our grandparents.
And we like refugee. We tend to feel more comfortable with certain groups than others, and there's been racism and nativism for the entire period of our existence as a country. I just want to add one historical, to reinforce Dan's historical point. In the beginning, when many of our conventions were formed, we were a very weak nation internationally. And other countries were poised to pounce on us because we had very, very little military force and very little diplomatic power. And so in some ways, the current situation is one in where we're really dealing from strength, and the concerns about the rest of the world seem somewhat overdone a bit compared, just the historical point, compared with our beginnings.
Well, I just wanted to jump in with one other distinction that's really important and that I think is significant in the case of these two executive actions. The president sometimes has the authority by a statute to, or maybe constitutionally, to just say something and that's it. But many of these executive orders by Trump involve situations where the president is not really the one who's got the authority. It's the head of EPA or the head of the Justice Department or somebody else. And all the president can do is basically direct them to use their legal authority. But their legal authority may be subject to a whole number of strings about having to have hearings and a special kind of rulemaking procedure. And I think part of what happened in the immigration case was the problems that were posed by these restrictions on what the Immigration Service could do. A lot of these executive orders are really just photo ops.
So a presidential memorandum which says we're building a wall, you still need to have money to build the wall.
You need to have money to build the wall, and he can't build it.
Right.
He's got to be telling various other people to make decisions to, you know, I don't know, buy bricks or whatever. But that's subject to government procurement laws.
Environmental impact statements.
Yeah, could potentially. For example, one of my major interests is climate change. So if he wants to change policy on climate change, by and large, he's got to get EPA to do things, and those things require very complicated legal procedures. And nothing happens until those procedures are complete. Whereas there are other things like the immigration ban, where the president can designate classes, and that's what he's relying on.
Well, he only has personal authority in connection with the statute that I mentioned. That's unbridled, essentially unbridled authority. Everywhere else, Congress really runs things in immigration policy, by and large.
Well, let me jump to Professor Yu here.
Yeah.
Peter makes a makes an excellent point, which is when it comes to international relations and national security, that's where the president's power is at its apex. That's where you were operating. You were focused on national security issues in your time in the executive branch. So why don't we look at a couple of the orders that have been issued, and I'd like your thoughts on them. One, which seems to be within his power, but is questionable, is the restructuring of the National Security Council, initially leaving off a couple of traditional principals who have intelligence backgrounds, and instead adding a political advisor, Steve Bannon. Is that the sort of thing that gets done through an executive order? And then secondly, even if he has the power to do it, is it a wise idea?
That's a good question, Jeff. First, we have to separate what's good or bad as a matter of policy and then what's legal.
Yep.
They're different things. And so I personally wouldn't want Bannon on the National Security Council. I wouldn't want Bannon on the Undergraduate Admissions Committee at Berkeley. I wouldn't want Bannon on a lot of things, but that's a totally different question than whether it's legal. And so the president, there's a statute called the National Security Act, which sets up the National Security Council, and it establishes only certain members. But presidents have always exercised discretion to add people to it. And the National Security Council itself is, as you know, is I think about 300 mm-hmm. staff people. The statute doesn't mention any of them, right? The statute only talks about roughly five cabinet members and the vice president being on the council. So presidents have just sort of said, I'm allowed to pick my advisors, and Congress can, if they don't like it, they don't have to pay the salaries of any of these people, but they do. So I think the president does have the legal authority to add and subtract who he wants to be his advisors on foreign or domestic yeah. policy. Putting aside whether it's a good idea to have someone like Bannon involved in foreign policy.
Let's stay on international relations for a moment. One of the most significant memoranda that's been issued by the president was the one eliminating the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And again, first, does he have that power to do it by a memoranda? And then secondly, what does that do as a matter of national security? Is that a wise use of executive power?
That's a great question, and this goes to something Dan mentioned about we're fighting over presidential power from the day George Washington took office. And the very first fight I think we really had about foreign policy was the Neutrality Proclamation. Did the president have the authority to say the U.S. would be neutral in the Napoleonic Wars? And Washington claimed the power. The Constitution doesn't really address it. And ever since then, we have, you know, our system has accepted that the president is the one who sets whether we're going to be friendly or hostile to other nations. And so from that power, presidents have always claimed the right to terminate international agreements. It would be a much harder question if the Trans-Pacific Partnership or the Paris Climate Accords had ever been submitted to the Senate for ratification or implementation by Congress. But because President Obama never sent the TPP or the Paris Accord or the other big one you didn't mention is the Iran nuclear deal, yeah. all three of them are just made under President Obama's power. President Trump can reverse anything President Obama did. Any president can reverse what a previous president did on their sole authority. And so if President Obama had been, I mean, politically it was not possible, but constitutionally the smart thing would have been to get Congress to approve all three of those. It would have made it much harder. Some presidents still claim the right to terminate even treaties or congressional executive agreements implementing trade, but it makes it politically harder to do that.
Right.
So I think he can terminate TPP, and I think he can terminate the Iran deal, and I think he can terminate the Paris Climate Change Accords.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the question of whether he can terminate a treaty that's been ratified by the Senate or where the Senate has given its advising consent, I think is a lot harder. But in these particular cases, I think it's pretty clear, particularly unless Congress had taken some action to, you know, for example, adjust our trade laws along the lines of the TPP or something like that. I think it's pretty clear that he can, as a matter of U.S. law, do that. Now, the international community may or may not recognize that as relieving us of our international obligations or parts of our international obligations. That's a separate question. But in terms of what a U.S. court would hold, I think he can do that.
And I think that goes to your earlier point, Jeff, about the DAPA and DACA programs, President Obama's decisions to ratchet down enforcement of removal authority over certain classes of aliens in the country. again, that's President Obama acting by himself. So I think it's a hard question exactly how far you can go close to zero, right? I think everyone accepts if President Obama said 50% of removals will be stopped, I think everyone agree you could do that. You know, it's a harder question if he said there will be no removals. But yeah. President Trump can come in and reverse the enforcement priorities that President Obama set because they were both based on sole executive authority.
Does this change if there are genuine findings and there are laws that are being interpreted that were passed by Congress? So recently the president just issued an executive order saying that he was rescinding guidance that had been issued by the Department of Education about non-discrimination against transgender youth. And the argument of people who support the Department of Education's position is that they're entrusted with interpreting Title IX. That's a law that was passed by Congress. They did an administrative process to interpret it, and they came up with these results. Is it really within the power of the president to just say, pay no attention to that whole process? There's a new president here.
Again, I think this is where President Obama might have been too hasty, because if he had gone through the formal rulemaking process and issued a regulation, you know, that had went through years of notice and comment and the usual process, which I won't bore you, but if you, this is like a Berkeley faculty meeting, then we would bore you, but this is not, so I'm not going to go through it. But there's this long process for doing regulation.
Right.
President Obama is very clever the way he did these. He issued these letters that were guidances that never went through a formal process. So that makes him vulnerable to President Trump then coming and saying, well, my informal guidance is the exact opposite. Yeah. If he had done a regulation, it would be much harder. Then you're right. The sort of status quo would have been built up to make it harder for President
Trump.
There's
actually a really interesting constitutional issue. Interesting means that nobody really knows the answer, or everybody thinks they know the answer, but they disagree about it. One school of thought says that the president has the power to actually direct, say, a cabinet officer how to perform their statutory duties. The other school of thought is that they don't have the power to do that, they just have the power to fire the person for not doing what they want. In practical terms, there's almost never any difference because cabinet officers don't want to be fired. And even if they feel strongly, they know they would just be replaced by somebody else who would be willing to carry out the order. But there is a question about whether, at least in theoretical terms, does that cabinet officer have the right to say, no, I won't do it, you can fire me, but as long as I'm here, I'm not doing it? Or do they have to follow the president's instructions?
Well, the one area this is going to come up, I assume Jeff's going to get to this, is what to do about claims of Russian interference in the election and whether to appoint a special prosecutor.
Yeah. Right?
Because this is an area where I think the Supreme Court mistakenly created a sphere where there was a executive officer, a prosecutor, who didn't have to listen to the president, or the attorney general can go off on a witch hunt if he wants to or she wants to. And it hurt both political parties in the end, and they decided not to renew it. But you're seeing calls for a new one.
So there was an independent prosecutor, and that was the vehicle by which you could have these completely independent investigations, which led to a number of investigations that kind of went too far, I think, as people look back on them, including the whole investigation that led up to the impeachment of President Clinton. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there's a special prosecutor, and that could be established, which would not be entirely independent. How would that play out in the event that there's a determination that there was some either collusion, which would be the most dramatic set of charges against people within the campaign, but even if there was just a conflicts of interest, undisclosed financial connections that may have limited their ability to perform the job as they committed to when they took the oath of office, how would that work with the special prosecutor?
So I think it partly depends on what the Justice Department regulations say about these things, and I don't know the answer to that. But I would assume the Attorney General has the power to pick somebody and say, okay, your job title has just changed, you're now a special prosecutor, to investigate this. Could the president stop that? At least in practical terms, I think the answer is yes, if necessary, by firing the Attorney General and get somebody he likes better. On the other hand, politically, that might be very, as Nixon discovered, that kind of thing can blow up in your face. And so it might be as a political matter that he wouldn't have any choice. I don't think there's any mechanism to force the Attorney General to appoint a special prosecutor now, but I would assume that there's discretion to do that.
Well, a lot of this goes back, I think, to the point of Peter's book, which is a lot of these come down to, notwithstanding the Constitution and all the rules that have been developed by the Supreme Court, a lot of this comes down to politics. The manner in which rules get pushed through by a president depends on whether they have a permissive congressional environment where the Congress agrees with them, or when there is a hostile Congress and they have to find some clever ways of trying to push forward their agenda. And similarly, the extent to which a president is willing to exercise raw power is going to depend a little bit on what the public will put up with. And if you have to fire the entire Justice Department in order to keep them from investigating you, at some point the public may get sick of it. Peter?
Just a narrow but perhaps important legal point about special prosecutors. No cabinet official, such as the Attorney General, can exercise more power than the office has under statute. That's obvious by definition. But there's a question as to whether he can relinquish responsibility that is inherent in his statutory authority, responsibilities. So he could appoint a special prosecutor, and he could recuse himself from any supervision of that special prosecutor. But in the end, and correct me if I'm wrong, in the end, I think he still has to be responsible for the decisions that the special prosecutor makes. And in certain circumstances might feel that if the special prosecutor is going beyond what his or her legal authority would be obliged to reverse that decision.
Let me ask a question that tests that. One of the executive orders basically instructed members of the Trump administration and the executive branch not to enforce aspects of the Affordable Care Act if they didn't really have to. And didn't feel they needed to. And they could grant the maximum waivers, deferrals, and delays on it. Is that an appropriate exercise of a president's power, saying the law's in place? This is one that was actually came from both sides of Congress and signed into law by the president. And I'm just going to tell folks, don't enforce it if you don't want to.
I think it's questionable. Now, one question is, to what extent does the law itself allow them to have that kind of discretion and to issue waivers and so forth? But I think for much the same reason that John was talking about with the Obama's immigration order, to the extent that you're really just saying that you're not going to follow some parts of the law and you're not going to enforce them, I think that does raise serious questions. The president takes an oath to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, and there's got to be discretion there, but there may be some point where it stops being discretion and it turns into defiance of the law.
I think a lot of us make the mistake of thinking the courts are going to save us. And so, right, when the president chooses not to enforce a law, it's hard to think who has the right to sue to stop him, and is a court really going to I think that's a big problem with the immigration order, because if you look at the second order versus the first order, the second order has been written to basically allow everyone in who could have sued to stop the first order, right? So now permanent resident aliens are in, and now every existing visa holder is in. The only one who's really harmed are people who haven't got their visas yet. And that's very hard to have what we call standing. Same with the immigration order. Same with but that was the thing with Obama and the health care waivers he granted. It was hard to think who could sue to overturn Obama's granting of the waivers. And I think it'll be the same problem with Trump. If he grants waivers and says, you don't have to comply with the ACA, who has the right to stop him? Who's harmed by that sufficient to go to court?
Yeah, no, I think that is a problem, particularly
in the immigration context. There's a statute, Congress has enacted a statutory provision which makes review of visa decisions by consulates unreviewable.
Yeah.
It's one of those areas in which there is no judicial review.
Yeah.
Now, whether that's constitutional or not is a question. I think it's probably constitutional. It's very rare for Congress to enact a statute which precludes the courts from reviewing the situation, but it's not unheard of.
It was a strong ambassador's lobby that kept that from being a reviewable decision.
But also, like our city and state, San Francisco and California, we're going to, apparently from the news reports, start spending a lot of money to try to sue the administration to stop all these things. But it may be futile because these are kind of things I think courts are going to try to avoid. And it's really up to Congress to, I think, in these situations, to restrain the president, not...
I think that's primarily true in a lot of these. Not all of them, though. I think there are some where the result will be some action by an administrator that can be judicially reviewed.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from three distinguished professors at UC Berkeley School of Law, Daniel Farber, Peter Shook, and John Yu. And they're in conversation with Jeffrey Bleich, who's the former U.S. ambassador to Australia. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now back to our conversation.
Let's talk a little bit about a recent example of Congress doing exactly what you're describing, trying to limit the power of a president to execute a authority which is clearly within the president's purview, the appointment of a Supreme Court justice. So Congress decides we just won't have a hearing, and we'll let that seat stay vacant, and we'll prevent this president from appointing anyone to the court. And in fact, we really don't like the way the court keeps reviewing our decisions. So Democrats and Republicans alike will sign up for this. And over the course of the next 35 years, we can empty the Supreme Court to zero.
This is sounding better and better.
Right. No, but that's sort of the logical extension of what was done by this past Congress.
It's like the reverse of what FDR tried to do, which was increase the Supreme Court to 15.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Which is lower it to the number you like.
Yeah. This is unpacking the court.
Yeah, unpacking the court, right.
Yeah. It seems to me that the Constitution clearly contemplates that there will be a Supreme Court. And it sounds like there'll be at least two justices, because one of them is Chief Justice.
That's the only one mentioned.
But you can't be a chief if you don't have any subordinates, so you got to have at least two.
You have not been in government. There's lots of chiefs without Indians.
Just as I think, you know, if the Congress decided just not to fund some important government function, some critical government function, I think in some sense that would be unconstitutional, not something that maybe a court could do anything about, but still a violation of their constitutional responsibilities.
I would just add a couple of related points. One is that I can't think of a situation which the court is less likely to entertain a challenge, a legal challenge to the failure of the Senate to hold hearings, and nobody would have standing. And so there are lots of reasons why that could never happen. But the broader point is that the Constitution, I think, does not answer all questions, does not provide a solution to all problems that are of a constitutional dimension. There are some things that have to be fought out in the political arena without judicial review in the waiting in the wings to rescue us. Some of that is because of standing doctrine, delineating the people who can and cannot sue. But some of it is just a recognition that some issues are not suitable for judicial review. There are a number of those in the Constitution.
Just make a point on the Garland. You're talking about Merrick Garland's appointment. I think the Constitution gives powers to each branch, and they can use them for whatever reasons they want against each other. President Obama could have actually retaliated by giving Garland a recess appointment to the Supreme Court, which would have lasted for 2 years until the midterm elections. Basically, you would have had, you know, he chose not to do that, but he could have done that. And I think Democrats in the Senate would be certainly justified in using their powers to try to delay any kind of vote on
Judge Gorsuch.
Has
there ever been a recess appointment to the Supreme Court?
Yes.
Justice Rutledge.
Harlan,
He would have had 1 minute in which to do it, because this Congress refused to have recesses. Yeah. And so they kept someone in the chamber at all times to prevent a recess from occurring. And there was only that 1 minute.
The metaphysical second.
the metaphysical second prior to the transition of power, mm-hmm. when if he wanted to do it, he could have done it, which I think people would have seen as a game.
This is a good example, because the Supreme Court recently, a couple of years ago, had to decide whether the Senate was unconstitutionally playing games. The majority was playing games by not recessing in that way. And the court essentially said, as I recall, this is not something that we're going to second guess.
So isn't this the point, though? I mean, as we're listening to all these sort of tricks and games that Congress has played, that presidents have played, the whole point of the constitutional structure is we're not going to put in all these rules. There has to be some overall commitment to making government work and to respect for each of the coordinate branches. And instead of having that, if you have that, then you're not going to push every one of these things to the ultimate. You're not going to say, okay, we won't have any recesses except for a metaphysical second. You're going to have a recess, and you're going to live with the consequences of it, and the president will live with the consequences of your expelling the person that they appointed during the recess when the next term of Congress begins. That is the way the process is supposed to work. It's supposed to work with respect, with an appreciation for the common mission of the three coordinate branches of government, and not for this attempt to thwart them at every turn to the ultimate limits of the Constitution. So what do we do about that?
There are other times in our history, like the Civil War, there have been other times, Civil War, Hamilton versus Jefferson, when we have had FDR versus the Supreme Court, we have high moments of partisan fighting, and then you do see the constitutional powers used to the extreme. I don't think the Constitution causes it. It's, you know, there's a high level of polarity, political scientists say, in partisanship now. And when you have that, then they will start using those constitutional powers, right? But it's not, I don't think the Constitution is going to fix it. You know, the Constitution is not, as you were saying, it's not sort of a perfect document and makes us all happy and prosperous. It's the politics are what's kind of poisoned first, and then the constitutional powers just follow in their use.
You're corrupted by that.
Plus, some of this conflict is over genuine uncertainty about what the policy ought to be, what the rules mean. So it's not all just partisan wrangling, and even the partisan wrangling is to some extent a disagreement about legitimate views of the Constitution or the policy question at issue. So defining where that line is between the area of legitimate political wrangling and the area of comedy in which they should conduct themselves in the way that Jeff mentioned is itself a very uncertain boundary.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a number of questions from the audience on a variety of subjects. And I'll start with you, Dan, on a question involving environmental law. Could the president, by executive order, suspend enforcement of the Endangered Species Act as applied to water projects to free up water for delivery to California water users? So he says there's an emergency, we need to deliver water to Californians, and the fact that these species can't come back, that's a problem for the next administration.
So I think that the answer to that is no, that he could not do that. And the reason is that the Endangered Species Act is one of the most sort of rigorously structured statutes that really narrows a lot of discretion. So on the one hand, a lot of things can be reviewed by the courts under rules that are actually pretty strong about, you know, it's not something where they say, well, think about whether to consider endangered species. It's a really strong mandate. There are deadlines for doing things, so if you don't meet the deadline, people can go to court. And there's a very specific mechanism for creating national exemptions from the statute in the national interest that requires a very elaborate procedure with what some people have called the God Committee, I guess because it has the power of life and death over species, but it requires a group of cabinet officers and they have to make findings on very specific issues. It's really only been used maybe twice in the whole time that the statute has existed, so it could possibly be done through that mechanism. But it can't be done by the president waving a wand. That's one of the areas where I think the Congress deliberately gave the executive branch very confined, limited discretion.
What if President Obama, he did the same thing that President Obama did with immigration law, though? He never said he suspended enforcing immigration law, but he said, we're going to take our time. We're not going to spend a lot of money on it. We're
Congress
going to focus on other people.
Congress thought of that because there are citizen suits under the Endangered Species Act. And so
drunk
an environmental group, which are vital. And which would allow, say, an environmental group to come in. And so it's harder in the environmental area to do that kind of non-enforcement policy because you do have these citizen suits as a backup.
Just one other point that's relevant to this and also the immigration situation. There is prosecutorial discretion. There's no question that the Constitution does not preclude prosecutorial discretion in any situation of which I'm aware. So the question is, well, at what point does the invocation of prosecutorial discretion amount to a disobeying of the law? I frankly thought that in the immigration context, the President Obama's order, which essentially exercised supposed prosecutorial discretion to exempt 5 million people from enforcement of the laws, exceeded his power. And simply waiving the notion of prosecutorial discretion over this doesn't really change that. So prosecutorial discretion is extremely important and is applicable in almost every situation of administration of policy, but sometimes it can go far enough that I think exceeds that.
Yeah, so, I'm not sure I agree in that case, although I do recognize that you're more of an expert. But, another area where Trump could easily change policy would be enforcement of marijuana laws, which have been sort of de facto. There's been an exemption for states that have legalized marijuana under some circumstances, but that's only an exercise of discretion not to prosecute, and I don't think there'd be anything to prevent the Justice Department from saying, sorry, we've rethought this, and we're sending in the FBI in force, and we're just going to start arresting people.
So one question is, how much power does Congress have to stop a president that they think is going off the rails? One of the questions that we have here is, could Congress require President Trump to release his tax data? As part of their investigation, they say, we want to know whether or not there are financial ties between you and the Russian government. And the only way we can know that is through the release of various financial data, including your tax data. Does Congress have that power?
Yeah, if they could pass a law, which would have to go through presidential signature, they can enforce
the what about a subpoena?
But they would have to override the current law, which makes it a criminal act, actually, to leak a IRS
but apparently
return.
There is something where Congress or some committees of Congress have the power to request tax returns under current law. But certainly they could pass a new law to do that.
But do they need a new law? Could they just issue a subpoena from a committee and say, you need to produce these documents?
For oversight purposes.
For oversight purposes.
Or an impeachment committee, say.
Right.
I mean, this is something I actually worked on both the congressional side when I was an aide and the executive branch side. Yeah, Congress could certainly issue a subpoena, and then they would have to enforce it against a recalcitrant president. You know, this happened with Attorney General Holder and the House in the last administration. And ultimately, even though the Congress issued a subpoena and a contempt sanction on Attorney General Holder, they never got the documents because, you know, he's told his U.S. attorney in Washington not to enforce the sanction. But this ignores the political ways you can do it, which is Congress has a power of funding. And I think that's their real source of authority to pressure the executive branch. They just say, well, if you don't want to do that, you know, then the Democrats in the Senate are going to filibuster tax reform.
Yep. Right? Or we won't pay Steve Bannon's salary.
He'll work for free.
Well, I guess a general point which John is giving specific instances of, it's really not very much that a president can do without some congressional support. If Congress wants to make it impossible for the president to act in almost any area outside of foreign affairs, they can deprive him of the resources necessary to implement a policy. He can say whatever he likes, but to actually do something, Congress has control over those resources. But I want to raise one other question, which I don't know the answer to, which is, aren't there some things that Congress might seek to do to a president that would invade the president's autonomy as an institution? That is to say, can they invade his privacy simply because they want to? Now, I don't think tax returns is a good example of this, but the argument could be made, I would guess, if they tried to go force him to disclose his tax returns, is that would be an invasion of some personal space. No?
I don't think so. I mean, there's the case of Nixon in his personal papers, and he claimed that, you know, the papers he had generated as president were private and they were his. He actually wanted to take them back to California and brood over them, I suppose, and sit on them like the dragon in The Hobbit, sitting on the mound of paper, I suppose. But he lost. The Supreme Court said Congress can force the president to produce all his now emails, Twitters, papers.
But those are papers
doesn't really have privacy.
Those are papers that are generated in the course of his presidential activities. Yeah. It's not the same as a tax return, arguably.
Oh, you mean things like that are private from before his presidency, before he was president. Well, that's the Clinton versus Jones case.
Right. I don't think he's got more constitutional rights to keep his tax returns secret than anybody else. And I don't really think there is one. It's filed with the government.
I hope you're right.
You know, they've got it. There could be things that would, I think there's been, you know, there's a lot of talk about hypotheticals. You know, suppose that they imposed such, you know, tried to restrict who he could talk to for advice, you know, under threat of a funding cutoff, or, allowed him to pass a statute that he can appoint anyone he wants to the Supreme Court as long as it's, you know, one of the three of us or something like that.
That would be a great course.
It would be, and that's plenty of
except for two of them.
Plenty of leeway. I agree.
Could they say that he has to work 12 hours a day or 6 hours a day?
Yeah, probably
something
not,
like
you know,
that. I think.
Yeah, I think. You know, I think there are limits.
Depriving the executive of resources. If they wanted to, they could make Trump's life really miserable by cutting the funding for the White House staff. That's how they should do it, right? They would just say, the funding for the National Security Council cut by 75%, then the State Department would be restored to its traditional position in running our foreign policy, right? And they could do that in every area, just cut away. There's a Yale professor named Charlie Black who said the Constitution requires the Congress to give the president maybe a desk and a pencil. Maybe, he said.
I mean, Congress does have a tremendous amount of power. Now, whether they would decide to use it, particularly in a situation where they're representing the same party, is a different question. But they do have the power to do a lot, up to and including impeachment, and that's again something the courts would never review.
So we've looked at what Congress's powers are. We have a number of questions about what the court's powers are, and many of them relate to the authority to limit actions in national security space. And so, John, you had to deal with this when you were in government. President Trump said a number of things on the campaign trail. He said that he thought torture should be used. He said that he would go well beyond enhanced interrogation techniques. I think the exact quote was, you know, they may be talking, but they'll talk more with the torture. And he also said that you needed sometimes to go after the family members of people who you suspected of being terrorists, because that would really deter terrorism if you killed their family members. So these would be things that would generally be considered cruel and unusual punishment of lack of due process and violations of the Geneva Conventions as well as other treaties. But if the president does that, is there anything that can be done other than to tell him not to do it again? Once he can he do it and so, then ask for forgiveness rather than permission?
So 2 points. One is on the judicial review, and then this other point about how presidents operate even when they're not limited by the court. So there was actually a lawsuit making these claims about President Obama's drone policy. Right, made the exact same arguments. And no court would hear it, right? But they made the exact same, you know. And family members of the targets of drone attacks are being killed still today, in these strikes. And they made all these same things: Eighth Amendment, due process. And the courts basically said, since this is a foreign military operation, in fact, at first they said they're not citizens, but there were American citizens who were even being killed in some of these drone strikes. The court still, on this doctrine that Peter mentioned, the political question doctrine, said this is an issue for Congress and the president to fight about. We won't hear it. And so there really hasn't been any judicial recourse yet. So what do you do? I think what has happened, in effect, is that Congress has tried to bolster the ability of the military and the intelligence agencies to refuse to obey the president. I think effectively that's what's been happening for the last 6 or 8 years. Not that the subordinate could refuse to recognize that President Trump is the commander in chief, but trying to create the conditions for them to say, I will not follow your order because I think it's illegal. And so the Congress has passed several laws to try to define what is legal for interrogation versus not. They haven't touched the drone attacks, though, by the way. I mean, Congress has passed no laws related to drone attacks. The language you mentioned, though, is reminiscent of what Thomas Jefferson had to confront with the Louisiana Purchase, though, because Jefferson thought the Louisiana Purchase was actually unconstitutional. Jefferson was really a strict constructionist, and he said, I don't see where we're allowed to buy land and create new states in the Constitution. So he said, I'm going to buy it anyway because, as an American, the price is too cheap not to buy, right? As Jefferson just couldn't resist how cheap Louisiana was. And then he said, exactly the words you use, he said, I'm going to go to the American people after and beg them for approval. And he said, public opinion will ultimately be the decider on whether what I did was right or wrong. But he admitted it was unconstitutional, but he thought it was so good for the country that the people would have to be the judge.
And Lincoln did the same thing with the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus. And Teddy Roosevelt apparently, received a subpoena from Congress, and he said they can have it when they pry it from my cold, dead fingers. presidential defiance has existed in the past. The real issue, I think you just nailed it, John, is that it's up to the public how much they're willing to tolerate that behavior by a president. And if a president is doing things that the public doesn't agree with, in 2 years, they can throw out members of Congress who they think are being too lenient on that president and express their views that way.
I want to almost completely agree with what's been said about the court's unwillingness to intervene in the national security area, especially in where foreign affairs may be involved. But I don't want to completely agree. I think we saw with the Guantanamo cases that the Supreme Court was more willing in the past to at least play some role in deciding about whether people were entitled to hearings about being held in Guantanamo, about whether they had judicial recourse. I think the courts are maybe a little less inclined to be, they're still not inclined to intervene, but maybe not quite as strongly. The other thing I think we may see is that Trump, I think, may not get as much deference as the typical president. I'm not sure of that, but I'm far from being sure of that. But I think part of the reason presidents get deference is that we think, whether it's Bush or Obama or whoever, that they have access to information the rest of us don't have. They're weighing major security issues, and we just don't want to interfere with that. To the extent it starts looking like that's not true, that the president has access to the same Twitter sources the rest of us have, and that the president is not paying much attention to what seem like the interests at stake, if judges become convinced of that, and they may or may not be, but I think to the extent that they start thinking that, they're going to be just a little bit less inclined to give way.
So we're down to the final 2 minutes, and we just received two very interesting questions. So I'm going to read both of them to you, or put both of them out there, and you can answer whichever one you want. You've got, this is a speed round, so 30 seconds.
Lightning round.
Lightning round. First is, could impeachment apply to a conflict of interest? Could a president be impeached for failing to uphold their responsibility to give full faith and allegiance to the United States because they have conflicts in support of other countries? And then the second question is, could the president actually punish the city of San Francisco either because of its rules relating to marijuana or because of its rules relating to sanctuary for immigrants. Can a president actually seek revenge against an individual town or community?
Well, the first question I think is pretty, my guess is we'll agree. That would be an impeachable offense. The Constitution does not define what high crimes and misdemeanors means, and it's certain that the courts would not second guess a judgment about political offenses that constitute the grounds for impeachment. So I think that would clearly be ground for impeachment.
I think liberals are going to be originalists after the next 4 or 8 years, because
right.
The original understanding of the Constitution, which has not been our practice, is that you could impeach a president for being stupid. I think people are going to be really interested in that again. But you were allowed, the framers thought you could impeach a president just for making a mistake, for just making a bad decision. The British, where we got the idea of impeachment, they removed people through impeachment just for losing battles in wartime. It was thought not to be this, you know, you did something criminal or wrong. It was that you were a bad president. But we've lost that because of the way we've used the impeachment power in a very narrow way since.
You know, I think there is some dispute among historians about the original intent in those terms. But even if there are limits, one of the things that the framers clearly would have regarded as a basis for impeachment, and that I think, you know, that fits with our traditions, would be owing allegiance or, being at the beck and call of a foreign power. That's one of the reasons why the president has to be 35, because they were afraid that some king of maybe England would put, you know, some offspring into the White House as a way of controlling the country. On the other question, I'm not familiar with the statutes, but the cities get funding under a whole bunch of different laws, and they all have conditions and when funding can be cut off. And it's not at all clear to me that any of those would apply to allow a funding cutoff in this situation. But you'd really have to sort of dig into the books.
No, one other thought. No. Can you send National Guard into San Francisco, confiscate all the pot brownies, and start rounding up people?
What a party.
On the second question, there are these funding programs for joint cooperation in law enforcement. And I think that's the one the White House is talking about. And I think they do have the discretion to. Now, I don't think the city of San Francisco gets a lot of funds from these programs, right? That's what you would have to do. You'd have to go program by program and make a finding and cut San Francisco off for each one. On the National Guard, that's interesting. You would have to declare essentially a national emergency, right, to trigger the deployment of the National Guard and the collapse of law and order. And I'm told when people eat a lot of these brownies, they actually become very passive and don't actually violate any laws.
They
just
sit on their couch and eat. Looking at the audience, I think that's true.
I think the National Guard one is actually easy because there's a statute called the Posse Comitatus Act that prohibits the use of the military for law enforcement. I think they clearly could not be sent in. They could be sent in to restore order if these people got rowdy, maybe, and it was a national emergency.
Reverse.
But they can't be sent in to enforce criminal laws against people.
Well, that concludes this part of the session of the World Affairs Council.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can join us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured three professors from the School of Law at the University of California, Berkeley, Daniel Farber, Peter Shook, and John Yu. They were in conversation with Jeffrey Bleich, who's the former U.S. ambassador to Australia. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Our recording engineer is Brian Copenhagen. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.